Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Harry Rosenfeld was with us last week. He's just penned a memoir of life as a newspaperman from Kristallnacht to Watergate. Last week, we spoke mostly about Kristallnacht. This week on the program, we will discuss Watergate and much more. Rosenfeld is editor-at-large, an editorial board member, and a consultant at the Times Union in Albany, New York, where he previously was editor. Before that, he was metro editor at the Washington Post, where he managed reporters Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein in the Watergate investigation that earned the newspaper a Pulitzer Gold Medal for public service. Jack Warden played Rosenfeld in the movie. We begin today learning from Rosenfeld about the conflict between political and journalistic decision-making at the Washington Post during Watergate.
The politics of that was key, from my point of view, my obligation, was keeping that story under Metro's control.
Right.
And keeping our Metro editors on the job.
Meaning it started as a break-in on the Metro desk, and no matter where this goes, we're going to stay with
it. That's right. We are doing the investigating. We're finding these things out. We're learning about the money trail. We're learning about the dirty tricks and so forth. The National desk, which naturally would deal with a story of this of caliber, at first they belittled our work, and then they resented it, and then they wanted to take it over. So that's where the politics came in.
Sure.
From my point, to keep it in our hands, and I had to argue strenuously to keep it in our hands, but they didn't disturb me. Well, they disturbed me, but they didn't take it out of my hands.
Did they ever threaten you?
They didn't threaten. Bradley didn't threaten. Bradley brought it up, and he said, well, why don't we turn this over to the National? They're much more experienced. And I argued it's because we were inexperienced, because we brought the fresh eye and shoe leather reporting, none of which I said, all of which that the National staff was thought already too good to do, right? That's why we were winning, and why do you want to change a winning game plan? It's ridiculous. Bradley never bothered me afterwards, but my opposite number on National kept on plugging away.
Sure.
To belittle, to undercut.
And not to offend
that's
you.
That's politics.
But I assume you would do the same thing if you were in that person's role.
I tend not to answer on the point of my Fifth Amendment rights.
But meaning it's a hell of a story and everybody would want it,
yes,
right?
Yes, and in my history I have done that. I've been in fights where I took a bullet and stuffed it down my shirt front because I didn't want my competing editor to even see it. So it's not unknown to me.
And ultimately, it's healthy for the product.
It's healthy for the product if the right person wins.
And you, I assume, to this day, think the right person won.
Oh, I do, yes. Don't you?
I do. It is a story that I don't think any journalist could fathom of learning the power of journalism more than a story like that. And we use it to this day as the prime example. I assume, much like your early story in Nazi Germany that forever characterizes who you are, that something like this forever changes, maybe not even changes, but certainly gives you a sense of what it is that you're doing and puts it into some context.
I would not have been able to say it as well. That's exactly right. All my life, I've learned as I was doing. It isn't that I was hatched so smart out of, I learned by making mistakes. And I learned not to make those mistakes, but to make new mistakes. And I learned a great deal from Watergate. I think it is right that Watergate should be a shining light for journalism if you look at the right things in Watergate and not the wrong things. I think all of us who are involved with it, in fact, I know that it was inspiring. Rex Smith tells a story, my Times Union editor, that he was drawn into journalism by Watergate, by what the Post did on Watergate. So I see that all around me, and I think it's a good thing. What is required is that it really be understood what was done in Watergate, and that should be emulated, namely the shoe leather reporting, Do not go on assumptions. Do not go on old schoolboy ties. But find out, talk to people, get it confirmed. Hold your breath and put it in the paper. And success builds success, because then people started to send in stuff. When they saw that the Washington Post, throughout the country, they had word that the Washington Post was doing this when nobody else really was. And they sent us tips and information. Now, a lot of that was junk. And a lot of that wasn't junk, but we couldn't prove it. It wasn't fit to put into print. But some of that wasn't junk. And through that, we found a pattern of this political sabotage. And we were able to document that and do one of the two or three most important stories of our coverage in Watergate, namely the organized political campaign by the Nixon administration to undermine their opposition and whatever opposition existed, not only in the field of politics, but also in the field of society. They were contemplating setting up concentration camps to put people in proactively before they've done anything in times of emergency. I mean, this was a really bad bunch.
Recently, the latest and last of the Nixon tapes were released. Do you have great interest in that still, or have you moved on from it?
Well, I have interest in it, but I don't. It will tell us some more tidbits that we didn't know, revealing the character of Nixon himself. In my book, I do print in its entirety a tape that had not been published until it was published in my book, which tells of an encounter between Ziegler, his press secretary, and Nixon, in which Ziegler urges him on behalf of a cadre of people who were telling the president, "You're being too modest in the changes you're willing to make. This is much more serious. You have to let Haldeman and Ehrlichman and Dean go." And the president wasn't quite there yet. But after that conversation, he went on national television and he announced the resignations of the three of them.
After the story breaks, after the acclaim, after you win the awards, after a major motion picture is made, you still live with this. And I mean, you're one of the people that have the secret of who Deep Throat is.
Well, I didn't at the time. That's one of those peculiarities of this business. Deep Throat was not known to me by name, and he was not known to anybody else at the Post by name. Only Woodward knew him. It was Woodward's source entirely, not Bernstein's, Woodward. And when I asked one day after we had gone a while, because he figured in our discussions all the time, I said, Woodward called him into my office, shut the door, and I said, "Now tell me, who is this guy?" And Woodward thought a while, and then he said, "Look, I will tell you if you insist, but I have promised this man that I would never tell, because his job is at stake, and even possibly more." So quickly I thought, well, what am I going to do with this information? And I decided that the Nixon administration was probably going to subpoena us, take us into court, put us under oath, and make us tell the name. And I decided, I knew Woodward wouldn't tell. Mm. I knew Woodward's history. He would not tell. He'd wind up in the slammer. And I figured the more of us, and I would not tell, but I wasn't going to lie about it. So I said to myself, the more of us who are left to pursue the investigation, the better. And on that moment, I decided, let it stay. I don't have to know his name. It wasn't until a lot later that I recognized I had made a big mistake. I should have insisted, and I should have known. And it's essential to know in order to evaluate the reporter's own assessment. And if it has to be restricted, if possible, it should not be restricted to one person, but to several persons, in order to increase the reliability of the evaluation.
So when did you find out?
I found out when Mark Felt declared himself. And
because
I had suspected Mark Felt, because he was a FBI, high FBI official. I had somewhere along the line, I also asked Woodward whether this wasn't a fight among the FBI, you know, factions in the FBI. And as I understood Woodward to say, the answer was no. My problem with that is I don't remember the words I used to ask the question, and I don't remember the words he used to answer it. When Felt came out, I ran this past Bob, and he said he remembered none of this. So I have to put that caution on there. This is my recollection of what happened. So I didn't suspect an FBI person as we went on. But at that point, that's when I called Woodward, and I asked him, then it turned out that he had told Bradley. So I said, well, how come you told Bradley and you didn't tell me? Now, he told Bradley the day that Nixon resigned. And he said, because Bradley insisted.
Because I remember in reading Bradley's book, he talked about knowing and keeping that secret. But
he kept the secret from the time of Nixon's resignation until Mark Felt spoke out. But he didn't keep it from the time of the break-in in June.
When you think of that story and how it shapes all of you, I mean, it would seem to me to be a surreal experience to then suddenly have Jack Warden playing you in a movie.
Well, it is strange. He came by, as Redford did, as Hoffman did, and he finally showed up. He was the last to show up of the three. And the writer showed up, and the director showed up. And so he spends time. By this time, I was the national editor. And he spends time with me, and he shares a cigar with me, a cigar that I could never be able to afford, even today. And we play tennis, and we only play one day because he wiped me so clean, I'd never had the appetite for any more engagements. But he told me, I'm not playing you. I'm playing a role. But he did adapt some of my characteristics, the way I rolled up my sleeves, the way I wore my tie pulled down, and so forth. So when the film appears, and my children, and not my children so much, but my nephews say, did you really use all that bad language? I said, of course, it's only a film.
You're 50 years old. And you leave the Washington Post, and you come to Albany, New York.
Yes.
How conscious a decision was that? What led to that?
Very conscious. I had been at the Post 12 years. I had had a number of assignments, foreign, metro, national. I'd been in charge. My last assignment was in charge of the book review section and the book reviews, as well as the Sunday opinion section. I was having a good time. I was mingling with the best people. But I also recognized that as an assistant managing editor, that's all I would ever be. I would never be managing editor, and I would never be executive editor, because the people in place were nearly of an age or too entrenched, and it wasn't going to happen, nor should it have happened. And I wanted to run my own shop. So I was open to offers, and an offer came from Albany. And while I didn't think at first hearing that I would be interested, I thought I should have a look. I did. I liked what I saw. I especially liked Roger Greer, who was the publisher. And from that, after a tiresome negotiation, we came to Albany.
And what experience do you think you brought with you that changed the paper?
Well, I know I was hired to make the papers better, the Knickerbocker News and the Times Union. That was my explicit charge that was given to me. That's why they hired me. And they hired me because of my experience both at the Herald Tribune and at the Washington Post. Mm. They saw I had a track record. I had a history of work record of accomplishments. They also knew what kind of an editor I was, that I was a demanding and hardworking editor, and that's what they wanted. And when I saw the papers here, I said, well, I can help them. I looked at the papers and studied a couple of weeks' worth, and I said, I can handle this job. I can do it. And I wanted to do it. I wanted to be an editor without any modifiers in front of my name.
Does being a journalist, being an editor, does it matter where you are in the sense of being an editor is an editor if you were in New York at the Herald Trib, if you were at Washington, at the Washington Post, or if you're in Albany, New York?
Well, yes and no. I mean, in some aspects, of course, it's the same. In other aspects, it's not. I mean, you're dealing on a different scale. You're dealing with a staff that is generally less experienced. You're meeting other challenges of the kind that when you're a more local newspaper, you have other stringent obligations to do certain basic reporting and the other kind of stuff. What usually gets lost in this formula is the other kind of stuff, right? That's sublimated, and that's the danger. And the trick, I mean, it's more in some ways more tricky on a regional paper level than on a metro level, but it's also more demanding in another way when you're playing in the big sandbox.
And it's still a political paper, right? I mean, it's still New York State's capital. It's still politics at a high level.
I think that's one of the charms that attracted me to Albany and the size papers, because it was a state capital newspapers. New York State is an important state, and it is very much a major activity of the Times Union to this day, as it should be. And it is known throughout the state and has credibility throughout the state because of the quality of its work. And it's recognized by other newspapers for the work it does this very day.
The newspaper that you write about, of course, in your book, The Washington Post, has recently been sold, which was really unfathomable for many, many people, that after so many years in the Graham family, it was leaving and going to Jeff Bezos of Amazon fame. So is that just one in a long line of changes in the business and something that you're hardened to, or does it have more of an effect than perhaps you thought it would?
Well, when the news came, it stunned me. And it literally stunned me. I knew that the Post had been trying different things to recapture its market. It had lost a lot of its readers. It's ironic that, you know, when I was there, we built it up to, and then my successors built it up even more. And much of that had been lost. And there seemed to be no way out. When I messaged Don Graham, the head of the Washington Post Company, my regrets and my sadness, he told me not to be so sad not to be sorry, because they saw that the way ahead could not be overcome by the things that they themselves were able to do. And they recognized that if the Post was to have a future, that somebody else with a different framework, with a different basis, bringing a different skill set, might be able to do what the Grahams continuing to do what they had been doing as the paper declined was only going to lead to oblivion. So he sees it as a redemptive action, and I trust Don Graham's judgment.
Even in the book, you seem to have an acceptance of the change in journalism and the changes both technologically as well as culturally that a newspaper have gone through that many in the business do not seem to share, that there is a nostalgia that takes over of what the business used to be as opposed to an understanding of what it is now.
Well, I'm nostalgic with the best of them, let me tell you. My memories are sharp and keen and always will be with me. But to me, I've come to realization after long thought and struggling to keep papers in print. I struggled to keep the Knickerbocker News alive long after everybody around me was saying, you've got to merge it, you've got to merge it. to me, what is most, when I distilled what is most important about my life's work, it is the content and not the format. I've accommodated myself to the fact that the format is changing and may have changed irrevocably, that, God forbid, news word on paper disappears entirely. But even if that were to happen, that on the various devices is, yes, unknown and unnamed, that the stuff you read on that or are able to read on that will have the substance and the veracity that the best of journalism was able to produce. And that's what scares me, whether that isn't just too big a challenge.
Because we get sidetracked by the business. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but just to see if I have what you're saying, and that we get sidetracked by the business, and it is the content that suffers.
The content suffers in journalism because the content is expensive. And the better the content, the more costly it is. So you can put out a paper with a lot of information and a lot of words in it, but if it's just reporting the surface of things, it'll cost you $100. But if you're going to go find out things and find the truth and spend time and effort and energy, that's going to cost you $1,000. There are people in the newspaper business whose job is to count the beans. And, the bean counters don't know the difference between the first version and the second version. They really don't. That I'm one or the other, they're equal. And there is that natural drive to always hold down expense. And if your paper is managed well, then that expense cuts into flesh, you know. And not only into flesh, soon enough it cuts into bone. I think the future of the Post, for example, for me, non-expert, is the Post always prided itself on being a local newspaper, which was very good for me when I was Metro editor because it was a card that I was able to play.
Sure.
But it's really a mistake in these days. The Post should be a national newspaper. It should find its niche in Washington, God knows. That's still the core, the center of this activity. But throughout the nation, there are pockets here, there, and the other place that craves this material. And I think the new technologies permit that to happen. You can now print, if you're still printing, all over the place instantaneously. You don't need a large printing plant in Washington and the trucks or the trains or the planes to ship out the paper. You print it wherever you want to print it. Or you don't print it at all. You just provide it in a, you know. But will the people read it? Will they have the patience? Will they have the focus to read it? It scares me. Why does it scare me? Because the biggest business in these new devices has been pornography. They did the best business. It wasn't the news. They didn't read it for the news. They read it for the dirty magazine that they don't have to be embarrassed buying at the newsstand anymore.
Given that you went through the Herald Trib going out and think of your current position as editor at large and a consultant for the Albany Times Union, it has to creep in that the problems that you dealt with then are still problems that you're dealing with now, and I'm sure will be dealt with decades from now.
That's
as well.
Right. And I spend a lot of my time dipping in my oar, saying the people who's in the seats of power, what I've said to you, content, content, content.
Well, there's wonderful content in this book. It is from Kristallnacht to Watergate, Memoirs of a Newspaperman. It is published by Excelsior Editions. Harry Rosenfeld, a great pleasure to have you join us and have you share your brilliant and incredible career with us.
Thank you so very much.
A great pleasure. Again, the title of the book is From Kristallnacht to Watergate, Memoirs of a Newspaperman. It is published by Excelsior Editions. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about the show. You can email us at book@wamc.org. You can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program, Bookmark Us, for next week, and thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.